Welcome to this special edition of Dutch Wine Apprentice, the podcast. This episode was recorded at ProWine 2024, the world's biggest trade fair for the wine industry. In this episode, we interview two of our previous guests, Bibi Gretz from Tuscany and Tim Gray from Jackson Family Wines in California.
Hello and welcome to Cellar Talks special edition by Dutch Wine Apprentice. And today we are here at ProWine 2024 with two guests, and one of them is already with us, which we will introduce in a minute. And we're going to talk about the respective estates, the wines, and of course about ProWine and wine trade shows in general. So a little chat to give you guys a little bit of a behind the scenes view. And before we go more in depth, let's start with the first guest. So, Tim, can you please introduce yourself for us?
Sure. Thanks, Niels. So, my name's Tim Gray. I work for Jackson Family Wines. So, we're a Sonoma-based California wine producer with a handful of wineries in other parts of the winemaking world. I look after their exports in Europe and the UK.
Okay, and actually we had some time yesterday to sit down and taste the wines. We will talk more about that. It could have been a podcast for an hour or two if we needed to, because you will probably tell us that you have quite an impressive number of estates. But first of all, maybe start with a quick introduction on how you got into the wine business. You can tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I was doing an office job and I decided that maybe getting into wine, I could spend a bit more time outside of an office. So that was my driver. So my first port of call was actually getting some qualifications. So I did some through the WSET, and following that, joined a large UK retailer who have a lot of my peers will have gone through their management training program. And it's fairly varied from there. I decided I wanted to become a sommelier, so I became a sommelier for a few years, working in high-end hotels in and around the UK, south of the UK, and then moved into wine sales with a little stint at a winery in between. Okay.
So actually, you know a fair thing about advisory of wine, working in a restaurant. Of course, you're a keen wine lover yourself, and you've done all these certifications. Then you end up working with a winery in the end. Well, it's not a winery, but it's a group of wineries. So how did you get in connection with Jackson Family Wines? Because this is the family company we're talking about today.
Yeah, it is. So I was actually just lucky, really. I was working for a UK-based distributor, and Jackson Family Wines have a fair footprint in the UK, and they were looking for someone new to join their team in their export side of the business, in the international team, and I was lucky enough to get approached. So I was approached by the head of Europe, and she seemed to like my knowledge and my experience, maybe my accent, yeah, who knows. But yeah, as I say, I count myself very lucky to work for them. They're a good company.
And
yeah.
How many years again is it now?
So it's just coming up to 3 years.
Okay, nice. Yeah. So I think I've asked you the question before, or if I didn't, then I'll ask it again now. How is it to work as a European in a US company, which is a global company, mind you, but...
It's great. It's very cool. So working for an American company, but being a Brit, it's a lot of fun. So we get to go out to the US at least once a year. And obviously being able to go to California and everything about the wines we produce, the Sunshine State, it's a lot of fun. The sunshine doesn't appear so much in Britain, so
so that's your bonus.
Exactly, yeah.
And
exactly.
The great wines, of course. But also, you cover Europe, right? Or if I'm correct, so this is your market, what you're looking after?
It is, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think there seems to be interest, growing demand for US wines. I think understanding the regionality of them is important. It's a big, you know, California is a big state with lots of varying climates and soils, and I think the knowledge is growing, and with that makes our job selling it into Europe makes it that much.
Yeah, so you got a tailwind.
Exactly, a bit of a tailwind. Yeah,
good. And meanwhile, we have Bibi who joined us. So Bibi is our second guest. Welcome, Bibi.
Hi, hello, good morning.
So we had an interview, it was last summer or the end of the summer, I think. So a nice chat, and we talked all about the great estates and the wines that you produce. Actually today we want to talk a little bit more about that as well. The people can always go back to listen to our previous interview. But maybe for those who don't know you, and I don't think there are a lot of people, but introduce yourself quickly before we go into what the winery does.
Well, I am born in Tuscany, on the hilltops overlooking Florence, and I've developed an interest for winemaking and became a winemaker in 2000. Mm-hmm. And coming from a family, my father's an artist, so always looking at perfection in forms, and my mother is fantastic. She's Norwegian, but she became a real Italian mama, doing fantastic food.
So we wouldn't recognize her anymore as Norwegians. That became really Italian.
So she's there. She spent all her life on doing fantastic food and amazing. So when I started doing wine, I had this idea of doing something that was really standing up to the standards of really art, quality, perfection, and warmth also, of these things here. So, okay, I'm a bit megalomaniac, and I want to do the best wine in the world, and the most fantastic. But then behind, I come back with these values, which I bring with me and try to be focused on. And I've always been in love from the first moment for making wines from very, very old vineyards. So I started my first vineyard when I started in 2000, was already more than 30 years old. Now we have many vineyards that are 70 years old, 88 years old, 98 years old, 135. And they all go into Colore, which is our dream of this wine with old vineyards. And in the same time, I've been always I really believed in the capacity of making really elegant fruits in the heights, in the mountain tops. So I have all my vineyards that are on mountain tops, and somehow it became also a very interesting thing, also kind of a futuristic thing somehow, because we have all our vineyards that going up to 650 meters. So we very fascinated by the red fruits, by freshness. Mm-hmm. No, so Testamatta is an expression of freshness, Sangiovese, which shows this acidity, elegant acidic elegancy and freshness. It's not really a typical Sangiovese.
Yeah. So Colore and Testamatta, just to recap, these are two of your hallmark wines that a lot of people probably will recognize also when they see the labels, but we can talk about more of that. But like you said, they're in Tuscany, centered around Florence, in different vineyards.
Well, it's spread also in different areas of the Chianti. So we have some vineyards on the at Lamole in the on top of Chianti Classico. So it takes like 1 hour to get there.
It's not really all that close by.
Not all that close by, but we have many vineyards that are like 10 minutes from the winery. No, okay. So but the winery is in this center of Fiesole in the square. So I took a old hotel, was a building of 1860. And transform it in my house and the winery. So it's a kind of you have the used to be a little disco, and so we have the.
So for the people, if they follow you on Instagram or social media, they will see that you also like the parties as well. It's not just the winemaking; it needs to be fun as well.
We have been always very, party baker since we were small, and we never
stopped with that.
No. So, actually, this is one of the reasons why I started making wines, because we have been for my family. I was born, they always had in this country place, and they always had, it's a very international family. My mother's from Norway, my father's from Israel, my grandfather come from Germany. And it's like we had friends all over the world, no? And they were all gathering for the harvest and coming to, there were two hectares of vineyards and picking all together, and then a big
party. It was
party.
A big fun party.
It was a big, the annual, I mean, the annual event of the family, kind of, no? Nice. So when I started, the certain with the end of the 90s, this thing here was collapsing because it was very decadent, and it was definitely not worth, I mean, economically, and one should decide, I mean, or we leave it, because it's not convenient. I mean, we were selling the wine bulk for 1.8 euro, no, 90 cents a liter, no? Mm-hmm. It was the price, and it was, but we had people farming and stuff, so it was
just enough to keep your heads above water, but not more than that.
Yes, it was just more or less enough for paying the two people that between the oil and the wine, they would kind of know.
That's so, just enough to get food on the table and a roof atop of your head.
Yeah. And so I was in front of a choice, and one of the reason that made me choose not to leave it was actually I couldn't understand how I could live without the harvest party.
So the party got you through it. This is what convinced you to keep on going.
That's nice. Beautiful.
Let's talk a little bit more about that later. Before I would like to make a little bit of a comparison, because there is a reason why I put you, the two of you, together here. Obviously the profile and identity of the companies is very different. Mm-hmm. On one end you have an artist who makes his wine with old vines and is like deep roots in Tuscany, on an island as well, which we'll talk about a little bit later as well. But you have your own winery, and you're also the winemaker. And then we've got Tim. And Tim, you already mentioned you got a lot of estates all around the world, even in Italy. So maybe before we talk about the differences between that and also maybe what brings you guys together, can you give us a snapshot of how your wineries are spread, Tim? Because you already mentioned California, of course, as a origin.
Yeah, so a snapshot of where the wineries are and how they came about. Yeah, so our home is, as I mentioned, Sonoma in California, and 3/4 of our wineries are California and Oregon. But the family, so we're family owned, the family like to travel. So, and when they travel, they like to drink wine, and they like to drink good wine. So naturally, France being a region which is you know, very historic in wine production, we ended up with Saint-Emilion House in Bordeaux. We have a Chianti House, so Tenuta di Argeno. We also have a South African estate, which is actually a nice story. So our winemaker Graham, who looks after Capensis in Stellenbosch, he was actually our viticulturalist and winemaker in Sonoma for a long, long time, over 15 years. He was actually one of the first South Africans to be employed in California in oenology. So he went back to the Cape, and the family love it there, and they said,
so he convinced, you told me yesterday, he convinced him basically to let him start his project over there.
He did. And he loves Chardonnay, and that's where Capensis came from. Yeah. He decided that he could look across the Western Cape, and similar to yourself, looking at altitude and different soil types, and something that stops the, you know, really challenges the vines. And brings freshness and acidity and minerality to the wine. So he's done that with Chardonnay in Stellenbosch, taking it from 5 quite distinct regions and historic vineyards, and blending to make a complex Chardonnay.
So Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are still very important for you guys, but you do have some other varieties as well.
We do. Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are very important. Cabernet is very important to a lot of California wine producers. We have some other fun bits and pieces that, as sales guys, we're very happy to get access to. For example, we have a North Coast Trousseau from one of our producers, Copan, which are super early picks, really bright and fresh, lovely style of wine. So we have bits and pieces like that too.
So you also brought one of the wines. We'll talk about that in a minute. If you don't mind, we just already just start with it because we can enjoy it while we have the conversation. So cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.
So a bit later, you can tell us all about this wine.
Sure.
But Bibi, listening to this story and then vice versa, I will go back with the same question to you, Tim. How do you look at, there's a lot of wine producers in the world, a lot of wineries, also but a lot of groups, winery groups. Obviously, this one is also still family owned. But how do you see the difference between what you are doing and what they are doing? I didn't prepare the questions, by the way, so I'm trusting you have a nice opinion on that.
No, I mean, absolutely. It's I kind of struggle to see myself in a situation in a winery like that, in a structure like that. But mainly because I'm lazy. No? I mean, I
that's a fair answer, but you know yourself, so that's good.
So I kind of made this project on the island.
Yeah,
on the island of Giglio, which is such a struggle because already you need to have to get to the ferry, and then you get to this micro world with like 200-300 people living in the winter, and
it's further away. You don't have it in your line of sight.
It's really tough. So it kind of satisfy all my needs of doing something away from Florence. No. Mm-hmm. The reason why I actually went to do this project on the islands is because when I've always been a water guy, so love the sea or love the mountains, skiing, the snow, no? So I was like, shit.
That's it.
In Florence, no? I don't want to be stuck in Florence. So first thing, I went to the island, no? Actually, you know, and a couple of days I was in Norway. I went there for a friend's party. And before I met the journalist the day before, and we had a nice dinner with many different guys in Norway, journalists, and he said, "Hey, Bibi, well, I told the story, no?" And he said, "I think you should make a wine in the snow." No?
You guys go quite high up.
Yeah, we go pretty high too.
Why don't you make a wine in Norway?
Yeah. Time is ripe for that.
So actually, we have been in the last 2-3 days, we have been talking because my importer, they bought a fruit company in Norway. They have 6 hectares of grapes. So we're actually maybe going to do
it. Someday, maybe you're going to make a Norwegian wine and add it to the portfolio.
Yeah.
So, how do you wine sell internationally? Because of course your focus is on Italy and on Tuscany and Giglio, but then the wines go around the world, so that's not different to what they are doing.
Well, absolutely. You know, we sell all over the world. We sell in 70 different countries, and we get there in different ways. We go directly to North America. Yep. And to Italy, and then we have a mixed system for the rest of the world, which is the Testamante and Colore. So our two top wines goes through La Place de Bordeaux, exclusively. So every single bottle that goes around the world goes through La Place de Bordeaux of those two wines. And then we keep the entry level wines, which are the Casamattas, the Sofocone, the Bollamatta, the Sparkling, and the and we keep them with our prior distribution system, so the classical distribution. So we have it kind of a dual situation.
This is what you changed? Because before it was all in the same way? Or did
before it was only the classical way. And then in 2000, with the 15 vintage, we moved. We decided to move to the Plus. It was a big important thing for us, and it really helped us a lot in
How does that, because it's interesting for a lot of people listening as well, because Le Palace de Bordeaux, I mean, some people will know, but some people will not. It's a big, they come from the Négociance in Bordeaux, and it's a big way to get your wines in the right places in the world. But what was your thinking philosophy when you changed your distribution into them?
Well, you know, we have Testamatta and Colore are wines that are very untypical for Tuscany. No, it's a Bibi Graz wine. It's not really Tuscany.
First of all, Bibi Graz, and then what's in it?
Yeah, it's Bibi Graz wine, and it's an expression of Sangiovese, which is really unique. No, I mean Testamatta is one of a kind. You don't find another Sangiovese like that. Mm-hmm. And also Colore is really one of the kind, no? So it's a unique wine, and it's hard to go solo completely in the distribution. I'm not a...
You don't have the sales force like they have with, I don't know, how many salespeople do you have around the world?
We have quite a few.
Like dozens, probably, if you add
more than
all.
Dozens, yeah. Around 30, yeah. So
we are three.
Yeah, no? So you need to be smart.
No? So it's a different story. Obviously, it's a different, we're moving different volumes of wine. Uh-huh. So I thought that Laplace would have been perfect for my wine. So I've been trying to get near Laplace many, many years, and then I managed in 2015. Yeah. And it has been an important move for us.
Well, now you see increasingly producers outside of France coming to Laplace with one or a few of their wines, sometimes even producing particular wines for that.
Yeah.
With you, it was not the case. It was the other way around. You see a brand and identity, and you wanted to find the right way to bring that into the market. But it's picking up, I would say.
Well, listen, it's we were the first brand that came into the Place in this whole new generation movement. So I think it was very important. We have been like 1 year only us. And then the first 2-3 years, it were 4 or 5 wineries. And now there is lots more wineries. Yep. But we got a lot of... tempo, no? We gained a lot of tempo by being
solo. So it really
solo.
Picked up,
by being alone at the beginning and
first mover advantage.
The first mover is very important. No, it's like also doing wines in the top of the hills. Now everybody's thinking, no, we need to go up on top of the hills because you know the cool climate for the climate changes and stuff. We are there already, and we have the best spots.
Yeah, it's hard to get in between that now.
So and also during, I mean, my style of wine, I moved towards doing a very elegant style of wine, but at least I realized this thing here like 7 years before the others. No, I realized it in 2000 with the vintage 2009, that was a very weak vintage, and wines were really transparent naturally. We were used to at the time really concentrated and super powerful Sangiovese, and I mean, the more the better, no?
Yeah. That was the mantra.
Green harvest, 600 grams per plant, bleeding, new oak, bono, everything there, no? And then we did this, they had this 2009 vintage, which was naturally, no, a weak vintage because there was huge grapes. It was impossible to concentrate. Now, whatever you did, the wine were transparent, no? And I was a bit, as usual, a Taliban. So I said, no, I don't want to mix vintages because everybody in Tuscany mixed vintages.
They were just doing that to get something decent.
I just went, you know, solo, boom. And the wine were completely transparent. So I arrived in Vinitaly with a Testamatta. There's people, what's this? Wow, this is very Burgundian. Wow, what interesting. And then the year after, we had 2010, again, super power. I was going around on the market, and I was showing 2009, this weak thing, low score, so 92, 93 points. And I came with 2010, 98 points, boom, huge blockbuster. Now, and people were saying, wow, this is fantastic potential, great wine. Well, okay, give me two cases of 2009 all over the world. It's like, holy shit.
That was your turning point there.
People don't give a shit about concentration anymore. It's like they're fed up.
Apparently, we had it wrong for a long while.
We had it wrong. People are fed up. So I just realized, and it was 2009 vintage. So I was going around in 2011, and I started I was like a smack, and I started working for giving more fertilizer, start moving the soil, getting the plants to produce more grapes and to get the grapes I had in 2009. I wanted to have larger grapes, more water in the system, you know. And it took me until 2015 to really reach this, no? Yeah. With some big fuck-ups in the vineyard also.
Well, this is where you learn. This is where you learn, huh? No. So, Tim, you want to tell us what you brought for us today in the glass? Because when I asked you to bring a wine, you said, okay, I can bring a lot of nice wines, but let's start with the start of the story. So tell us a little bit about what we're drinking.
Sure. I think, Bibi, talking of fuck-ups, actually, this is a really nice story that relates to that. So our founder, Jess Jackson, late 70s, he decided to grub up an old pear orchard in Sonoma. And at the time, Cabernet was massive in California. And actually, he wanted to do something different. So he planted Chardonnay. And his vision all along was actually mountains, ridges, benches, something that would set his wine apart from what you find in California, which is, as you know, super warm. So some kind of cooling influence. And anyway, so first vintage he made got stuck fermentation. So super sweet, horrible, awful. So we thought, what are we going to do about this? So he called in his winemaker friends and they actually blended it from different regions across California and called it Vintner's Reserve. Because
so
of that,
it's an old Californian wine.
Yeah. And what happened next was he decided, right, I'm going to chuck it in my backpack. And he went over to New York, took it to the best restaurant he knew, which was the Oyster Bar in Grand Central Station, listed it. And then, boom, it's been listed there ever since. So that was 19...
Yeah, just put it in between there and then it happened.
1982, 1983. So from that mistake came what was essentially a new style of Chardonnay.
And then many followed in California.
And many followed. And I'm sure there were others doing it at the time. But for us, you know, it really is. We have a lot of wines. Yeah. And we always have to remember, you know, how important this wine is.
Where it come from.
Is for us and where it comes from. And it's, and you know, and Jess Jackson and kind of his vision. And ever since there, he was obsessed with quality. Yeah. So controlling every single part of the process. He wanted to use good quality oak because he realized that made his wine more complex. And having...
You even told me the story about getting the oak and making your own barrels out of it because you want to be in control.
Exactly that. He wanted to be in control of every part of the process. And as they increased production, he realized how important the oak source was. So actually went early 90s, went over to France and they purchased a stave mill to control the oak that was going into the barrels that they were making. And so we use a lot of French oak in our wineries. A little bit of American too. You'll notice you get the slightly kind of sweeter spice with this. It's 50-50 more or less in the Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay, French to American, but less than 10% new on both of those.
Nice. Thank you. So, Bibi, we already talked about the islands. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more because, well, we started with Sangiovese, not only Sangiovese, the reds, and a big part for Sangiovese, and there is other varieties, indigenous. But the island is a different story. You already told me a little bit about what your feelings are about the islands, about the wines and the grape. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you're doing there.
Well, the island is a very special place. It's like a real pearl of the Mediterranean. It's a mountain in the sea. It's 1 hour off with the ferry boat. It's 500 meters high and 16 kilometers by 3. So it's really steep hills. Mm-hmm. There is no flat land, and all the cultivation is on terraces, small terraces of 1.5 meter by 1. Or let's say the wall is 1 meter and the wideness is 1.5 meter normally. Mm-hmm. You have terraces with only one or two plants in with all the walls around. So it's like really an incredible human work that mm-hmm. has been done in the past. And there are 1,000 years old terraces. And we go there, clean them, and plant and
hold Sonica, them right?
And Sonica, we are planting a bit of different stuff and playing a bit with many different things from the Mediterranean, you know. It's the beauty there is really, really striking, you know. It's been for me very important because when I, as a winemaker, when I arrived on the island, there was still a lot of very old guys and doing wine, old farmers. And I was, there were like, when I arrived in 2000 on the island, there were like 60 wine producers. That the wineries were more or less not so much bigger than this room here, maybe two times.
For the people that are not here, this is not a big room.
No, I mean, you're talking a medium winery in the island is 25 square meters.
Yeah,
that's the size of a old cantina. But they're incredible because they're 1,000 years old and there has been done wine inside there for 1,000 years. So, and they... Everybody had their little parcel on the island and they made their own wine. And you were there on the island and there was obviously no enology, but you were talking, it was like talking, you know, all these guys, they were all the best of the world.
Yeah, talking with each other, mouth to mouth.
And no, stories. But it's like, it was like talking with Pierantino, Angelo Gaia, and Paolo Conterno, they're the best of the, I mean, that's the best wine of the world, finito. Yeah. It's like, this, when you are on the island, you feel a bit like isolated. It's like, everything is away from the island.
It's a different world.
No, it's not. It's not that you are away. Everything else is away. Right?
I love that.
It's like the center of the world. No? Yeah. And I learned a lot because these guys, there were some guys that were doing the most, they were doing wines that were, so-so.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I mean, tough to drink, no? Yeah. Tough stuff. And some guys that were doing incredible things.
So the differences were quite big.
Difference was big, but when I started doing wine, I started in 2000, I didn't have any know-how, so I should take a winemaker, no?
Yeah.
But meeting and being together with all these guys and seeing what they were doing, it gave me the strength to just start doing my thing, also without being... Yeah. I never opened a book of enology, you know? And I just, after 3 years of doing my wines with the winemakers, and now...
Together with them, yeah.
Now I go alone. I mean, I start going solo, and also the Sangiovese and all the production.
I started.
And if I didn't have the experience of having all this, farmers doing incredible things without any know-how...
Yeah, the confidence that they have as well. Yeah. Well, for them, it comes natural, but...
Self-confidence, you know. Yeah. And not only just self-confidence, but they're incredible wines, you know. That maybe it was just one... small barrel, but you should, I mean, a dream, no?
Oh, that's good.
So that's... Okay.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but I would also like to thank Tim, because you're going to be leaving us. There's a lot more work to do here on ProWine for you.
A few more meetings, yeah. I've got to shoot to a meeting now, with a distributor, yeah.
So thank you very much for your time. We'll be writing more about you guys. There's some new stuff coming up. For BB, we already published some things. We'll talk a little bit more together. We still have some time, but thank you, Tim.
And Niels, thank you. No, thank you very much for having me. And to meet BB, I love your wines. So, yeah, I'm a massive fan.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Tim.
Thank you. So now Tim's out of the room. We can freely talk about old world. No, that's a joke. But maybe a little bit, because there's a lot of talk going on about old world and new world these days, recently especially. I know you have a certain view on age, but more on age of vines. How do you see the wine world coming together? Because of course, you listen to a story, US wineries, there's also a lot of old vineyards in Australia even now, South Africa. How do you see that those two definitions?
Well, listen, I am a new world guy in an old world. No? So I've been more like a Californian winemaker or like an Australian winemaker.
You could be a surfer in California.
Yeah. I mean, no, really, because I have been looking for these old vineyards, no? Around in Tuscany, and these old vineyards are not for sale.
No.
plus I didn't have the money for buying them. So it was a combination of things.
Yeah.
So combination that we built up the whole winery with contracts,
yeah. You know,
buying grapes
or
or creating relationships with growers and following them and bringing them all to work organically and to work, I mean, to work with our own philosophy, following them and helping them to really get the result we wanted, to follow our style of winemaking or of wine growing. And so this is not a real typical old world school, no?
So you, important is the vineyards, but the way you do it and also how you started, because you didn't have a winery background. You didn't study winemaking.
No. I mean, for me, when I started, I was completely convinced that the man was the only thing that counted. I would talk with winemakers and I said, oh, just bullshit. The only thing is the work that you do. And I was so convinced about my work. Then after 25 years, I must say that I was totally wrong. And now I realize that it's the terroir. It's the only thing that counts, because when you have the terroir, whatever you do, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you a funny story. I was in Norway last year. We'll go often in Norway. Yeah. It was the birthday party of my brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And they made a big party in the mountain. And there come these guys, two or three freak guys, that have some grapes in Røa. It's like the hill overlooking Oslo. And they have some grapes. And they went to visit me once in the winery, and they got inspired and said, let's make wine.
We're going
to
do it.
60 kilo of grapes. So they came and they made wine tasting for me, up in the mountains, the Westland.
Well, you would never expect it.
And in fact, the wine that I was saying, but this is strange, because but they didn't know anything about winemaking, so they just bought some beer yeast for making the fermentation,
just to get them started.
And then whatever yeast they found in the first shop, and no spraying in these grapes, no nothing, just completely. They don't even prune the plant.
Just let it go free.
Yeah, it's completely. Yeah. And I tasted this wine, and I said, oh, strange. I must go and see these grapes. So last night, I went to, yesterday night, in the dark, to see these grapes. And I was shocked, because the grape must be like near to 100 years old. It's like old trunk, big like this, like 30 centimeters thick, growing in this glass house. In Norway. And no doubt the wine was good, because a plant of, 100 years old plant,
it knows how to work its terroir.
It's so funny.
So, you see, it's, grapes and wines is a thing of the world. And, so maybe to conclude, old world, new world, it's all not that different. It's what you do with it and how you interpret it, maybe the terroir and what you do as a winemaker. But and the vineyard is not
absolutely no. It's the terroir is crucial. No, terroir is crucial for wine, because what you drink is what you come from the soil. So it's really crucial. But then it's the starting point for a process. And if you need to have a good terroir for a fantastic wine, but then. No, it's like my mother's making the most beautiful sweaters, but she's not Prada.
You still maybe want a Prada next to the sweater of your mother. Yeah, so you don't want to say one or the other, but maybe both. Good. Well, Bibi, it's been a pleasure talking to you. For everybody listening to this, actually, we have a special edition today. We're at ProWine, so we would like to thank the people of ProWine for having this amazing professional studio in the middle of a trade show.
Amazing, wow.
Who would have thought that? So think about grapes and vines from Norway. Well, a podcast studio in a Messe in Germany. So thanks for those guys for setting this up. We will be starting also a new podcast series. It's called Grape Master. Masters, which is starting in April. And we're going to talk with great winemakers of the world. So I think we should do another interview because we did one already, but maybe you should be in that list again.
I'll be happy.
For everybody who's listening, by April, we will release the first episode with Mike Radcliffe, who you might know, Villa Fonte. So they come from Warwick Winery with the family in South Africa. Very different story. But his project started about, I think, at the top of my head, 23 years ago. So it's around the same time as you. With nothing. So he didn't have the old vines, but he started with good soil analysis and all of that. So we're going to talk with Mike in the first episode of Grape Masters. But this was, let's say, the in-between, the special edition, the Pro Wine edition with Bibi Graz and Tim Gray, who's not here anymore. But Tim, thank you for being here. So
Bibi Graz.
Okay, there we go. Thanks for correcting me. And cheers one more time.
Cheers.
And
thank you very much.
Good luck with the wines.
Bibi. Thank you.
This was the final episode of Dutch Wine Apprentice, the podcast. In April, we are launching our new podcast, Grape Masters, in which we focus on leading wineries of the world. Be sure to follow our new podcast channel, which will be available on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, and directly on our website. To stay up to date about the launch and the upcoming episodes, visit our website www.dutchwineapprentice.com and follow our social channels on Instagram and LinkedIn.